Welcome to Work of Art, the Mason Gross podcast, produced out of Rutgers University's Mason Gross School of the Arts in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We are a community of nearly 1,200 undergrad and graduate dancers, musicians, theater artists, filmmakers, and visual artists from around the globe. My name is Laurie Granary, and I'll be sitting down with some of these artists, discussing what fuels their curiosity, their passion, and their impulse to make. Jazz performance undergrad Vaughn Stavropoulos likes to joke that playing the saxophone involves nothing more than employing that old blow and wiggle. But I don't believe him. Because the moment you meet him, Stavropoulos' steadfast devotion to his craft is evident. Stavropoulos grew up submerged in music. His dad was a professional bassist, and his mother sang and played the piano. There was talk of Tchaikovsky around the dinner table. From an early age, Stavropoulos says, he understood that music is a powerful tool and that the role of the performer is not merely about hitting the right notes, but about striking an emotional chord and communicating with an audience. You know, when I hear you talk and I hear you talk about your dad and the kinds of conversations you were having with him about music, and what was kind of flowing around your house, it seems atypical to me. It seems sophisticated. And I know that's all you know. So maybe to you it doesn't seem sophisticated, but how important was that atmosphere of conversation with your father, who'd been a professional musician? And I believe you've mentioned that your mother was involved in your education, too. I think she was playing piano at one point. Yeah. And so talk to me about your relationships in your family and music and how those interweave.
Well, it definitely, it kind of changed a lot over time, but it's always been present. When I was very, very young, my mom used to put on like a lot of different, she had all these cassettes of like Tchaikovsky and different classical takes. Oh, thanks.
So she'd be playing this music for you from the time you were young.
Yeah, definitely.
So that was in the air for you. So talk about that, your parents' involvement, their own love of music, which is a parent, and of course your father playing music. How do you think that helped form you as a musician? How did it shape your worldview? I mean, I realize these are big questions, but
yeah, I guess I've never really thought about it that much. But definitely, I mean, little things like watching them talk about songs at the dinner table, just like bonding over, like recognizing a deep cut tune or, you know, something, really anything. I don't know. I guess it was always just there. I never really thought much about why it was important to me so much as that it was. But beyond that, definitely that there was like an emotional power to the music itself. And that it communicates messages in ways that words kind of can't. But also it's almost like it sets the stage for all the other kind of communication and opens the flow of communication in other domains.
Talk to me about that. What do you mean? I'm interested in how it sets the stage for other kinds of communication.
Well, for instance, if somebody writes a love song for another person, I feel like it's just very different from telling them how you feel. Especially, you know, you perform this song and then tell them how you feel. It's a whole other avenue of expression. I guess that's a sort of typical example, but in a broader sense, just the fact of expressing some type of message musically, and I guess being vulnerable in that statement. There's just that atmosphere in the room with the audience. It's like a kind of a bond. I don't know. It's almost like kind of the conversation that we're having right now, where one person is expressing a thought, or trying to in my case, and the other is listening and kind of, I guess, digesting. but just a little bit more abstract.
And I'm talking to you really mostly as a performer at this point, not talking about composing. How do you believe, as a musician, you are meant to serve the piece and serve the moment?
Got you. Yeah, there are certain, there are definitely certain musical devices that, when employed, will maximize the effect of delivery of the particular feeling that you're trying to convey. And I guess in so much as being familiar with language and responding to and doing your best to honor and address those facets, and doing so as a unit, as a band, really kind of delivering a cohesive message, and following the music as though it's like a wave, which it kind of is, but I mean, not like a sound wave, you know, like an undulation, like a shape, like a rise and fall of tension or interest or emotional energy or whatever you'll call it.
And submitting to that wave, right?
Definitely.
Submitting to that. So talking a little bit about music school, what surprised you about music school? What and what's been particularly challenging? I know this is your fourth year, so you have the whole breadth of the experience, practically the whole breadth of it under your belt. And I'm thinking that there's some prospective music students who might be listening, and I would love for them to hear about what surprised you, what's been challenging.
Well, on the surprises side, I mean, obviously I knew I'd be practicing a lot. I knew that there was going to be certain things, aural skills, theory, you know, that would be pillars, I guess, of the experience. But, I guess everybody always talks about like the spiritual side, or the, I guess, mental metacognitive side of the whole experience. And I guess there was no real way I felt to prepare or anticipate that. So I felt like I was looking for it. And I realized that it kind of just happens. You know, the way that the journey goes, the way that you learn in this kind of push a little, get a little, or pull a little, get a little, you know, two steps forward, one step backward kind of way, focusing on different things, juggling, trying to improve and maintain your various techniques, and focusing on ergonomics, trying not to hurt yourself, and then also balancing that with not sacrificing the expression, etc. I mean, I guess there were just many more facets than I anticipated, not to mention the actual, I guess, post-school, how do you continue to improve and bring those lessons that you learned with you so that you can continue to kind of self-teach going forward?
Yeah, I can imagine that's really heavy on your mind right now, trying to figure out how you carve out a life as a musician outside of this structured environment, right? Professors taught you in that realm. How have they helped you as you're trying to make that transition now mentally to post-school?
I guess structuring your practice into kind of different bubbles, some that will always be there to kind of maintain your technical facility and relationship with the instrument and with the music and whatnot, and then others that will develop to adapt to whatever it is that you're working on at the time, so that there's always this kind of space and time for you to focus on these different aspects of what you need to work on. One of the things that's really changed how I practice a lot is how Professor Bowen recommends keeping a practice log, so that, and it's really amazing too. I feel like it seems like it's just going to be this thing that you just have, and it's like, oh, cool, nice to see, like, you know, what I worked on, but at the beginning of the practice session, I feel like that's where the most time gets kind of wasted, because otherwise you're kind of fishing around, like you're warming up, et cetera, but you don't really know what you're going to need to dive into for your session. But if you have a log like that, then you can always look back and realize, oh, okay, this is what I was working on last time. I can start off with that. And then as you're working on that, you end up running into something else that needs a little work and cleaning up, and you kind of end up running the full gambit of your, anyway, everybody has their own, of course, but, you know, I'll run the full gambit of my warm-up routine, but in the order that it arises and whatever I was working on last time in the warm-up routine. So I guess kind of prioritizing the least crisp material in that section.
That's really interesting, the idea of having a log, having something visual, right, that you can take a look at and really get a sense of where you're going with your own practice. Have something there that is to kind of hold you accountable, I guess, right?
Definitely. Yeah, it lets you keep track of aspects of it that you would never otherwise notice. Like you can write down exactly how fast you practice the material. You can write down note for note, like what the pattern was that you were transposing, for example. So you can really like recreate the exact learning environment, you know, set the metronome, say 2 or 3 clicks higher the next time, just really try to stay on top of it.
Talk about competition.
Oh,
I know it's like the dirty word, it's got to be an element for anybody who's driven. And you can talk about any element of that. There's the good, the bad, and the ugly of that. How does that hit you? What was your awe?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I know there's definitely, it's present.
Even if it's latent.
Right. Yeah, I try as much as possible to keep it that way. Because I think it kind of, or at least the way that I respond to it, isn't really the most productive for what I'm trying to do. It's, I mean, I love enjoying what other musicians are playing and learning from them and, you know, exchanging ideas and practicing together and challenging each other and whatnot. I think the most productive practice spaces are those wherein musicians are not judging each other and it's everybody's competition is definitely, I guess, maybe of a more playful nature. It's like here's an analogy. So in high school I was on the wrestling team and they talk about how like when you're sparring, you know, you want to go at maybe like 70-90%, you know, so that you're working yourselves out, but you're not trying to like really go at your opponent because you're on the same team. You know, you're not trying to like at all costs, whatever.
That is an interesting analogy, and I'm wondering if there are times when competition can be good, can be even a kindness in it, if that makes sense. Like you said, a playfulness where you can inspire one another too.
Yeah.
And make each other better. Well, you know, you've spoken to me on several occasions about how your professors have inspired you, and I'd love for you to talk about that here. Can you talk about different times when you've had a professor who's made you think differently about competition or about a certain piece of music? I know you've talked about Abe Burton and how he transformed a particular piece for you. Tell me a little bit about your professors and their role for you.
Well, I guess Professor Herwig probably has one of the, in my experience anyway, the broadest catalogs of stories of peer motivation that's like, wow, like way to do it, you know? I mean, he's told us stories of how his roommate, in the most loving way possible, he would wake him up in the morning like, all right, you know, let's hit the shed like now, you know, and you know, Professor Herwig was like, oh yeah, okay, let's go. This cat comes back, dumps a bucket of ice water on him. He's like, no, like let's go shed, like right now. And it's like, okay. You know, and obviously we all see where he's today. So that's definitely inspiring. I guess the moral of the story, so to speak, is that there's never really not going to be other things to do, other time, just, you know, life things to take care of. So the extent to which we can motivate each other and work together so that we're not entirely estranged in that kind of like, you know, practicing doesn't have to be just a completely walled off experience.
What does it mean to you, for you to hear those stories from Professor Herwig or any of your other professors, knowing how successful they are?
Well, on the one hand, that's really what it takes. On the other hand, it reaffirms, I suppose, the notion that it is something to be desired like that. It's worth that level of paying attention to and chasing after.
Tell me what it means to you to be able to gig while you're still an undergrad student.
I'm very grateful for the opportunity. It's great. Yeah, it's nice to have the experience, I guess, kind of have a taste of what it'll be like afterwards. And the different avenues that would be available to focus on, as there'll just be so much more time.
You're playing around New Brunswick?
Definitely. A little bit in New Brunswick, a little bit in Jersey City, a little bit in New Hope. Pretty much wherever, you know, wherever possible.
What are you learning through these gigs?
Everything.
Well, that was my question, that you're not necessarily learning in the classroom. What are you gathering at this moment?
You know, I think and this is truly a credit, I guess, to the professors. The classroom experience is pretty accurate. It's just so interesting to see in person. The different aspects that make the scene what it is, and how, I mean, maybe certain stories that seem out of context, you know, in a classroom setting, it's like, wow, that's such a strange, like, how did that happen? What types of, you know, social assumptions and circumstances could have caused that story to transpire?
Well, give me an example.
I guess just when first posed with situations where it's like, okay, you're going to have to read, like, transpose the sheet music or play parts that weren't necessarily intended for your instrument or for, you know, just whatever subpar circumstances where it's like, okay, you know, this is not good. But then where, I guess, the mentality, like, when you're on the bandstand, you're faced with that situation. I mean, what could you possibly do? I mean, you have to do your best. And, I mean, hopefully it goes over. But that's why, I guess, it really stresses the importance of all that preparation, because, wow, I mean, you really never know what's going to be thrown your way. It's, like, kind of crazy.
Right. In the moment, in front of all those people.
Right. Yeah.
Who may have paid to get in and are waiting for you to, you know, resurrect their Friday night. No. Definitely. Pressure there.
Exactly.
I guess you learn flexibility and humility there, huh?
Yeah, I'd have to say so.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine. You know, Vaughn, what would you say to a prospective student who is perhaps apprehensive about applying to music school? Would you have any advice for them about music school, about Rutgers?
Oh, yeah. So definitely, I guess, music school in Rutgers. Well, because Rutgers is huge, right? So I feel like there's a bunch of wonderful opportunities that are available in all these different avenues. But at the same time, I mean, music school is such a time-intensive thing. So sometimes it feels that you might not necessarily be able to access all of those things. But ultimately, I would say the fact that it's like a close community, but really you do have access to the full spectrum of a huge university with I mean, such a broad array of not just disciplines, but I guess semiotic domains, like headspaces. It's really like, if you don't only talk to people within your major, it's guaranteed to be an interdisciplinary experience. I guess what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, and that it can be really stimulating in that way. You don't have to be in your little cell, right?
Definitely.
Yeah, for sure. You're not hidden away the way you could be at certain conservatories.
For sure.
Well, for you, why Mason Gross? Why did you ultimately decide that this is where you wanted to land?
I would have to say it's the faculty. really the faculty and the alumni. I mean, both as far as the faculty goes, I think it's pretty rare that you get such a thorough lineup of such experienced musicians who have played with so many great musicians and who are themselves such phenomenal, I mean, performers, composers, educators. I guess it was a combination, a little bit just of the fact that the professors have and are playing with and are people who I listen to and have admired for years. And also, I feel like out of the conservatories, I mean, locally, but really in general, I appreciate the emphasis that they place on jazz.
Talk to me about the importance that you feel the jazz program has at Mason Gross and what that means to you, that it's valued.
I feel like it's not information that's made available frequently in such an accessible and thorough format as it is here.
So do you feel that jazz is somehow treated as the redheaded stepchild sometimes at conservatories? Is that what you're getting at?
Definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Not to put words in your mouth, but I feel like that's where you're going.
Yes.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that because I didn't really know how to say it. But yeah, I mean, for example, and not to name individual schools, but in my search, I visited a couple of other schools and they were like, oh yeah, you know, we have a jazz program, there's a jazz department, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I'm sure you'll enjoy, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And then they show you and it's like, wow, this is literally a closet. There's one stage, you know, where like sometimes the one jazz band performs like once a year.
Oh, I feel as what you're getting at is there's opportunity here and access.
Definitely.
How do you think you're a different musician as a result?
I guess the mixing of many students at many levels does foster that kind of friendly competition that we were talking about earlier, where you can really see what, you know, what musicians will look like years and years down the line of having practiced and still willing to share that material. And it's like incredible. It's like, wow, you figured this out from this stuff, and to see that they once stood where you were, it's like you see the spectrum from where you stand to where they're at to where the professors are at, etc. And it's like it all feels more attainable.
I can imagine, yeah, being able to, like you said, see that full spectrum. And I'm wondering, what does it mean to you when perhaps a more advanced student, a grad student or a professor compliments you? What does that mean when this community is so accepting and positive about what you're doing?
It's definitely very encouraging. It kind of, I guess because objectively I feel that, you know, some of the stuff that I'm playing is like, wow, I'm sorry, you know, like, and so, you know, but the fact that it's relatable for people who have honed their abilities to such a high level and that they can at least feel like at some point, however many years, you know, ago, they could relate to that, like, wow, that's what I felt like. And I guess connect on that level and let the students know that. It's more inspiring than it is destructive because I think otherwise, I mean, it can definitely be frustrating trying to approach playing more and more difficult material, and it can be tempting to just kind of give up and be satisfied with whatever it is that we're playing as it is, when really, I mean, we can always push it to the next level.
Yeah, so I guess you're always in that mode, right? That mode of going to the next level, of trying to attain something. how do you not despair?
Sometimes it happens.
Sure.
I think, I guess the best recovery technique, for me is just kind of keeping it realistic, coming to terms with it as like, but it's not always bad like that. And I mean, we're working towards cleaning up the holes and the messes. I mean, I think just the fact, so sometimes I refer to this as stress practicing, but it's not like cramming or anything. It's just like, well, no, it's like whenever I'm stressed about my abilities or whether or not I'm going to continue to develop or, you know, if I've reached a plateau or anything like that. I just try to have a really slow focused practice on something that, you know, it starts in a comfort zone and then slowly pushes beyond. But so that at the end, I definitely feel like, okay, I'm at least a little bit more comfortable in something. And the sheer fact of having made some progress and then conceptualizing it as, okay, well, there's like 365 days in a year. This is like, how many hours, you know, did that just take? Just keep going. It's like, it'll be fine.
Well, yeah, that you're not a robot, so you're not going to be the same every day, and nor should you be, you know, and it's important. Yeah, the mental game's important too, isn't it?
Definitely.
It's huge. Can you talk a little bit about how in your ensembles, perhaps a professor has made you think differently about a piece of music or experience music differently?
So I remember one time in a lesson with Professor Gross, Mark Gross, that is. Well, we were talking about improvisation, and we were playing, I want to say Honeysuckle Rose or maybe All the Things You Are, some jazz standard. And, well, basically I was playing over the tune, but it wasn't really the most, I guess, expressive that it could be. And we stopped at the end and he says, okay, so that was pretty good. But I mean, how much of the instrument did you really use? Like, how big was the range that you were utilizing compared to the range that you have accessible on the instrument? And I was like, probably not that much. I was like, you know, maybe like in the middle upper octave for most of it. And he goes like, yeah, so try to think about using the full range of the horn. I mean, you know, but in a color based way, like in a responsive way, not just, you know, not just, okay, I need to use the full range of the horn, but like, what does it do when you use the upper range of the horn? What does it do when you use the lower range of the horn? Like, what happens when you play the same line in different sections of the horn, and why might you do that for different, sort of shapes, I guess, feelings that it induces. And that was the first time that I really, I guess, thought about like the aesthetic of the shape of the line as a standalone topic. So it's like, there's like the time that's passing, there's the rhythm, there's the theory, there's the harmony and whatnot, right? But what's happening inside of all of that? Like, what's, I guess, the contour of the line, the feeling of the rhythms, whether they're quote jagged or, you know, smoother, more even, whatever, and how that contributes to the actual feeling that's produced by even like the same notes is very, very nuanced. And I hadn't really had my coat turned to that before.
This, of course, makes me think, how important. So we've been talking about the technical aspect of it, and that there's so many technical aspects to master every day, to continue to try to master. But what I'm wondering is, how important is the emotional side of this, right? Because we're talking about colors and making people feel things. And of course, that could end up being manipulative, or in the wrong hands could Well, if you don't understand some of the emotions of the song, how do you play it? I guess is my question.
Yeah.
How do you play it when you might not understand it?
I'm so glad you asked that. That actually goes back to a very famous quote in jazz, which is, you can't blow it if you haven't lived it, which is, you know, you can't improvise and conceptualize of it if you haven't experienced the feeling. And I suppose that's sort of debatable. I mean, there's the raw, like, technical execution of the physical technique to make it happen. But on some level, I mean, if that technique is being used as a transmutation of that emotion, as opposed to just used as a stand-in for the emotion, there must be some type of difference. I think there is, as a listener.
So do you think, so how old are you now, Vaughn?
I'm 21.
21. So there are some people who would say, ah, 21, he hasn't experienced enough, you know, can he do this? What do you say to that?
I guess that's all kind of relative. I mean, for a number of reasons, but, everybody experienced different things by the time they were 21. That's probably the main one that I would go to. So, maybe let the music see if that's true.
I read somewhere once someone said, yeah, by the time you're 18, you've experienced a lot of things in Shakespeare. You've experienced jealousy, you've experienced betrayal, you know, it's easy to be ageist and say, oh, you have to have gone through half a lifetime to understand these things. But as you said, everyone's led different lives too. But there's a whole range of human emotion that's experienced
through
childhood. And definitely. Yeah. So I guess my last question really would be, what is it like for you to hold in your hands this music that has existed for so many decades and in some cases, you know, over a century? It's like you're holding this legacy in your hands.
Definitely. And
what does that mean for you as a person, as a musician? How does that touch you?
I think it's reassuring in the sense that what you're playing is informed by the past. It's always kind of, it's like standing on the shoulders of giants, as they say. There's, you know, you can check out what, say, Sonny Rollins, Charlie Parker, Sonny Stitt, Coleman Hawkins, Lester Young. I mean, it's Coltrane, you know, it's Dexter Gordon. I mean, I could keep on going, played, you know, on even really the same tune, because a lot of these tunes were so, I guess, standardized and commonly performed in those eras. Also, it's very, I guess you can feel extra connected to the lineage in the knowledge that those musicians were also playing back to the history, so that, you know, they would go back and they would check out things that happened. And when you really put it together, it's ultimately like, you know, people interpreting their mentors, interpreting their mentors, interpreting their mentors, going back for like 200 plus years. And yeah, it's part of a broader tradition than just, all right, let's play something, let's try to make this cool.
Well, thank you. I wish you great luck in this tradition, Vaughn.
Thank you so much.